From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Ron Reagan will not be at the Republican convention's tribute to his late father, but he will speak next week at the Democratic convention. He will explain why he supports embryonic stem cell research, which the Bush administration has placed restrictions on. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Reagan about why he's decided to speak at the Democratic convention. He'll also talk about his father's legacy and reflect on his own life as the son of a beloved and controversial president. Also, critic at large John Powers considers what HBO is doing that network TV is not. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. In the 500-page report issued today by the 9/11 Commission, there's harsh criticism of both the current and previous administrations, as well as the CIA, FBI, and Congress. The Commission does not say the 9/11 attacks could have been prevented, but a prominent Republican senator asserted today that they could have been. NPR's David Wellner reports from the Capitol.
Pennsylvania Republican Senator Arlen Specter reached his own conclusion about the 9/11 Commission's findings.
There is no doubt in my mind that had all of the information been available in a coordinated manner, that 9/11 could have been prevented.
But Speaker of the House Dennis Hastert said fault does not lie with U.S. officials.
President Clinton is not to blame for these attacks. President Bush is not to blame for these attacks. Al-Qaeda is to blame for these attacks.
New York Democratic Senator Charles Schumer said there's wider responsibility.
I think what the commission has done is told the facts, but not tried to point fingers of blame, because if fingers of blame were being pointed, they'd point just about everywhere.
Schumer said the whole society was asleep at the switch. David Wellner, NPR News, the Capitol.
The Army's Inspector General has released a report on his 5-month investigation into abuses at military prison camps in Afghanistan and Iraq. The report says the abuses were the fault of enlisted men and lower-ranking officers and were not the result of any system-wide failure. The conclusion drew criticism from members of the Senate Armed Services Committee, who said that investigators didn't pursue the cases far enough up the chain of command. India's foreign minister says his government is doing all it can to secure the release of 3 of its nationals taken hostage in Iraq. The kidnappers have threatened to kill hostages from India, Egypt, and Kenya unless their Kuwaiti employer stops doing business in Iraq. Veer Singh reports.
Indian Foreign Minister Natwar Singh told reporters that the hostages, all truck drivers working for a Kuwaiti firm, are not combatants and have nothing to do with war. Speaking in the Pakistani capital Islamabad, where he is attending a regional conference, Singh said India has appealed to friendly governments in the region for help with securing the hostages' release. The family of one of the kidnapped victims, who is from the northern state of Punjab, has appealed for his release through a private TV network. Indian diplomats are trying to convince the hostages' employer, a Kuwaiti trucking firm, to pull out of Iraq. India has not joined the US-led military alliance in Iraq, but a large number of Indians work there as drivers and contractors. For NPR News, I'm Veer Singh in New Delhi.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials gained 4 points to close at 10,050 in very heavy trading. The Nasdaq was up 14 to 1889. This is NPR News. Secretary of State Colin Powell said today that Sudan must act quickly to end a 15-month conflict in its western Darfur region. Powell met today with UN Secretary General Kofi Annan shortly after the U.S. circulated a draft resolution that would threaten the Sudanese government with sanctions. Powell said the Sudanese government must stop Arab militias from attacking the mostly black residents of the region, more than 1 million of whom have been forced to flee their homes. Sudan's foreign minister accused the U.S. and Britain of meddling in his country's internal affairs. The campaign of independent presidential candidate Ralph Nader went to court in Texas today in an effort to gain access to that state's November ballot. Ben Philpott reports from member station KUT.
Representatives of the Ralph Nader campaign appeared in U.S. District Court in Austin in hopes of overturning Texas ballot requirements for independent candidates. Nader was on the Texas ballot in the 2000 presidential election, but that was under state guidelines for third-party candidates, because Nader was the Green Party presidential nominee. This time around, he has to qualify under independent candidate rules, which require more than 64,000 petition signatures from voters who did not vote in the state's spring primary. Nader says those petition requirements are, quote, an unconstitutional and discriminatory burden. There was no immediate ruling from the judge. For NPR News, I'm Ben Philpott in Austin.
The Coast Guard has forced a Turkish merchant ship to anchor out in Delaware Bay after a crew member told an inspection team that there was a bomb on board. The crew member later said it was a hoax, but the vessel was prevented from docking at Philadelphia with its cargo of coal. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Novo Nordisk, working to improve diabetes treatment in the U.S. For 80 years, diabetes care has been our passion, not just our business.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Republican convention will include a tribute to the late President Ronald Reagan. His son, Ron Reagan, will not be part of the tribute, but he will be at the Democratic convention next week. And to some Republicans, this makes him a traitor to his father's legacy. At the Democratic convention, Ron Reagan will speak about the importance of pursuing embryonic stem cell research. Stem cells have the potential to develop into many different cell types. Scientists believe that these cells, when transplanted in a human body, can evolve into replacements for cells that have become defective or degenerated, and therefore can potentially help treat such diseases as Parkinson's and Alzheimer's, as well as spinal cord injury, stroke, burns, heart disease, and diabetes. President Bush has banned the use of federal funding for stem cells from embryos destroyed after August of 2001. We invited Ron Reagan to talk with us about his decision to speak Tuesday and to reflect on his life as the son of a beloved and controversial president. He's edited a new book in which well-known people are asked what they would say if they had 5 minutes with the president. Your father is the hero of the Republican Party. Why did you decide to speak at the Democratic convention?
Well, because they asked me. I'm aware that some people see this as the Democratic Party using me for some sort of political advantage. I suppose it's fair to say that they're using everybody who speaks at their convention. I thought about that, and I came to the conclusion that that may be true, but then I'm using them, too. And I thought it was worth it, worth the slings and arrows to get the word out about embryonic stem cell research, which is what I'm talking about.
Is this something that you would not have felt comfortable doing if your father was still alive?
No, I don't think that would have made much difference. My family's been involved with promoting embryonic stem cell research for some time now, and it's an important issue. It could be potentially an enormous medical breakthrough, and this is it's worthwhile, I think, to get it out there in front of the public, even if that's at a Democratic National Convention. I'm not a Democrat. I'm not a Republican. I've never belonged to a political party. Don't plan to join one. This will not be a political speech.
Why won't it be a political speech? You'll be limiting your remarks to stem cell research and not mm-hmm. a larger critique of the Bush administration, although you've been very critical of President mm-hmm. Bush in the past. So why are you limiting it to stem cell?
Well, that was what I was asked to talk about. And also, I'm aware that some people will be waiting to see if I seize the opportunity to lash out at the Bush administration or something. And I won't. That's not why I'm there. I'm there to talk about embryonic stem cell research, which should be a nonpartisan issue. It shouldn't be politicized at all. Now, I would argue that there are some in this administration who have politicized it. I think this administration's policy regarding embryonic stem cell research is wrongheaded. You will recall not too long ago, the president said that he would allow research on 60 or so existing stem cell lines. We then found out that there weren't 60 or so existing stem cell lines. There may have been, around a dozen. But in any case, that's not enough. It's not enough to carry the research forward. This is important research. It needs to be done. It could save millions of lives around the world. And that's just not a political issue to me.
How did this become your issue?
Well, it should be everybody's issue. I was interested in it when I first began reading articles in Scientific American and things like that, just talking about the promise of this sort of therapy, the potential for saving lives and helping people. And then, of course, my mother became interested in it. I think that she was probably drawn to it initially because of the hope that it might offer a cure for Alzheimer's, which, of course, my father had. That hope is still alive, although it will probably be a benefit to people who have other diseases before those who suffer from Alzheimer's. Nevertheless, that her interest spurred my interest some more, and we've just been speaking out on it when we can, doing what we can.
Now, because you're speaking at the Democratic Convention, there have been headlines like this, and let me read you a headline from the LATimes.com.
No,
okay. to GOP, he's dishonoring his father. Affronted Republicans scramble to discredit Ron Reagan's scheduled speech on embryonic stem research at the Democratic Convention. Are you feeling the heat? Are people trying to discredit you?
Oh, I'm sure that they are. I think somebody called me a grave robber at some point, which I thought was pretty over the top. This is expected. This is what some people who work in politics do. When they have a disagreement with somebody, even if it's over something like embryonic stem cell research, which is, you know, a medical scientific issue, they tend to try and personally discredit the messenger. If they can't really argue with the message, they discredit the messenger. We saw that earlier in other realms with Richard Clark when he came out with his criticism about pre 9/11 intelligence and all that sort of thing. This is just what happens. It's expected.
Now, you've said that you think embryonic stem cell research is being politicized. Mm-hmm. How do you think it's being politicized?
Well, I don't know what President Bush personally feels about embryonic stem cell research, and take him at his word that he thinks that destroying these very early stage embryos, we're really talking about the cellular level here, we're not talking about a fetus, we're not talking about something with fingers and toes. I take him at his word that he feels that that is tantamount to murder, that you're taking the life of a human being, essentially, when you do that. I would disagree. I think you can make a distinction. But if he's going to make that argument, and it is a moral argument, then you have to be, it seems to me, morally and intellectually consistent. Now, I haven't heard this administration call for the shutting down of in vitro fertilization clinics, for instance, where thousands of embryos are discarded every year. Those embryos are the same sort of embryo that one would be using in embryonic stem cell research. So if the embryonic stem cell research embryos are human beings deserving of legal protection, let's say, well, so are the embryos in the in vitro fertilization clinics. Now, nobody's going after the IVF clinics because that would be political suicide. A lot of people of all political stripes, trying to get pregnant, avail themselves of those technologies in the IVF clinics. So instead, we're going to pick on embryonic stem cell research in an effort, I suspect, to appeal to what people refer to as the base, the Republican base, which are made up in large part of evangelical Christians who have very strong feelings about life beginning at the moment of conception.
Were you invited to speak at the tribute to your father that the Republican convention will hold?
No, I was not.
Were you invited to attend at all?
No.
Your mother was invited to attend, and I think she declined, right?
I believe that's correct, but you'd have to check with her to be sure. I believe that's correct, though.
Did you feel that you should have been invited, even though politically you are not supporting the Republicans, but it's your father?
Oh, no. I didn't assume that I would be invited to the Republican convention. I'll be there working for MSNBC, doing commentary and coverage of the convention.
So you'll be at the convention, but representing MSNBC?
Yes, yes.
Will that be a little uncomfortable, being both journalist and persona non grata at the same time?
Well, this won't be my first Republican convention that I've been, at least on the fringes of, and I've been, not a Republican for quite some time, so I guess I'm used to that.
During the 2000 campaign, you said something that was very widely quoted. You said that you thought that George W. Bush was not qualified to be president, and you said, what's his accomplishment, that he's no longer an obnoxious drunk?
Well, yeah, I didn't put it exactly that way. That's how it was quoted. The words obnoxious drunk did come out of my mouth, but I like to think that I said it a little more gracefully than that. I was sort of posing a rhetorical question when I said that. He had just come out with his campaign autobiography, in which he played up his drinking problems to quite some extent and sort of put that up as a great accomplishment of his, which I don't argue with. He stopped drinking, and that can be very difficult to do when you've been drinking a lot. And I simply used that as sort of the tagline to several paragraphs where I talked about how and why I thought he was unqualified for the job of president. And, of course, that was the thing that was picked up and spread around. And, you know, I stand by it. I have to. I said it, so.
Well, thanks for the context. How does his performance in office compare to your expectations?
Well, of course, when I said that, 9/11 hadn't happened yet, so the stakes weren't as high, or they didn't seem to be as high. But I would say that Mr. Bush, on the whole, has proved me right. I think he is unqualified still to be president of the United States.
And are there specific things that you think he's done particularly wrong?
Well, the war in Iraq would certainly be at top of the list. We now know from the Senate intelligence report that virtually all of the intelligence that we had that was used to justify our invasion and occupation of Iraq, which has led to the deaths of hundreds of Americans, young Americans, virtually all of that intelligence was wrong. It was exaggerated. We were, in effect, lied to. We were, at very least, misled. The aftermath of the war, the occupation, has been terribly mismanaged to the point where you really have to say it's evidence of incompetence.
Let me quote something else that you've said. You said, the Bush people have no right to speak for my father, particularly because of the position he's in now. This was a couple of years ago. You said, yes, some of the current policies are an extension of the 80s, but the overall thrust of this administration is not my father's. These people are overly reaching, overly aggressive, overly secretive, and just plain corrupt. I don't trust these people. Do you feel like your father's legacy is in the wrong hands? Do you think that his legacy is being misrepresented or misused?
Well, they do try and hold the current president up as a sort of, clone or natural descendant of my father. And listen, there are political parallels, of course. Both men want to cut taxes. Both men believe in a strong military, let's say. But I reject the notion that this president is personally anything like my father. It's just not what I see. I knew my father, of course, very well. I don't know this man personally, but from what I gather, watching him on television, going about his job as president, he just doesn't strike me as a man who's very much like my father. For one thing, my father never had to pretend to be anybody else. He was very comfortable being himself. You never saw my father running around, or his people running around, trying to pretend that he was really another fill in the blank. You know, really another FDR, really another Nixon, I don't know, you know, whoever you choose. He stood on his own two feet. This administration seems reluctant to do that. They like to invoke him to, bolster their credibility, I guess.
My guest is Ron Reagan. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Ron Reagan. It's been about a month and a half since his father died. Did you feel any conflicts at the funeral between what you wanted as a son and what happened as, you know, in the funeral of a president? You know, I think there's a desire for a certain intimacy in a family funeral, but, I mean, he wasn't just family. I mean, he was the former president, so there's... Yeah.
Yes. Yes, you're right. And of course, we knew going in that there was going to be a certain amount of pomp and circumstance. Yeah, sure. Personally, I guess I would have just preferred to keep him close to home and, you know, put him in the ground quietly. But these are plans that had been made years in advance. He had approved them. They were his plans, my mother's plans as well. This is what he wanted. This is what he approved. And so, by God, this is what was going to happen and what we were going to do. And, you know, we just wanted to, as a family, I think, honor his wishes that week and do right by him.
You spoke at the funeral, and let me quote the part of what you said that was most widely quoted. You said, "Dad was also a deeply, unabashedly religious man, but he never made the fatal mistake of so many politicians, wearing his faith on his sleeve to gain political advantage. True, after he was shot and nearly killed early in his presidency, he came to believe that God had spared him in order that he might do good, but he accepted that as a responsibility, not a mandate, and there is a profound difference. Humble as he was, he never would have assumed a free pass to heaven. But in his heart of hearts, I suspect he felt he would have been welcome there. And so he is home. He is free." I think a lot of people assumed you were referring to President Bush when you referred to how some politicians do wear their faith on their sleeve to gain political advantage. Were you?
There was only one person that I was thinking of when I wrote and delivered the eulogy, and that was my father. Now, I think we can agree that there are some politicians that wear their religion on their sleeve. But I didn't have anybody in particular in mind. I was talking about his faith, what it was and what it wasn't. I wasn't even aware until a few days later that this had upset some people, what I'd said. Some people called me on the phone and they said, "Well, you know, boy, you sure kicked up a lot of dust with your eulogy." I said, "Well, what do you mean?" They said, "Well, you know, the thing he said about President Bush." I said, I never mentioned President Bush. What are you talking about?" I said, "You know, the thing about religion." "Oh," I thought, "I see." It was curious to me, and I think quite telling, that people who, some of them close to President Bush in the Republican Party, assumed when I said that I must be talking about him. Again, I find that quite telling.
Now, you've described yourself as an atheist, and let me just quote something that your mother, Nancy Reagan, wrote in her memoir. She said, "One thing that bothers Ronnie, your father, one thing that bothers Ronnie is that Ron doesn't go to church. It means a lot to Ronnie to attend church every Sunday, but Ron has a broad view of religion, and his own faith is individualistic and private. It bothers me that his father doesn't understand that he is religious in his own way." What was your father's reaction to your own stance as an atheist?
Well, he was disappointed because he was a religious man. He was a Christian. I remember I think I was about 12 years old when he came into my room one Sunday morning to see why I wasn't all dressed up in my suit and ready to get in the car and drive to church. And I told him that I wouldn't be going anymore, that I didn't believe in God, and that I would feel like a hypocrite going and sitting in a church and pretending. This just disappointed him, but he didn't say anything to the, you know, like, get your suit on, young man, and, you know, get your butt in the car, we're going. I think he realized that this is a decision that everyone has to make in their own lives. And while it bothered him, it wasn't his place to make any demands upon me that way. We had discussions about it. He tried to convince me otherwise. He even had the pastor of our church come and have a conversation with me, but I was unmovable. And you know, we would have recurring conversations throughout his life, throughout our lives together, about this. And I'm sure it did bother him, but... But again, he wasn't going to twist any arms to get his way.
You say your father didn't wear his faith on his sleeve, but he did have the support from the moral majority and others on the, you know, and other evangelicals and people on the religious right. And in some ways, he helped them establish themselves as a major force in the Republican Party. And I'm wondering if having a son who described himself as an atheist was something that he had to. That he felt he had to hide from some of his own supporters, or if he felt, you know, comfortable with that. And were you put in a position where you were supposed to not let that slip, you know, that you saw yourself as an atheist?
No one ever said that to me, and I, you know, I don't I'm sure he wouldn't go to a moral majority, you know, meeting or, you know, where he was going to be in a speech and say, oh, and by the way, my son's an atheist. I don't think that would make much sense. I don't think he would invade my privacy that way. And, you know, it's not something I feel compelled to shout from the rooftops or anything. It's come out lately, I think, because people have asked me recently, you know, won't you run for office? Aren't you going to get involved in politics and, you know, run for some higher office? And the answer is no. I'm not interested in that at all. And the best way to forestall it and nip that in the bud is to just say you're an atheist, because everybody knows, having read the polls, that if you're an atheist, you can't get elected to anything, at least not above dog catcher. So,
how did you realize that you were an atheist?
Well, I've always been interested in paleoanthropology, for instance. I remember when I was 4 years old playing in my room, my mother walked in and I'd been sort of mulling over a question for a while. And I looked up at her and I said, Mom, were Adam and Eve the first cavemen or the first people as we know them today? I actually used the phrase, as we know them today. And she sort of looked at me with wide eyes and said, I think the first people as we know them today. But, you know, I began asking those sorts of questions early on, and it occurred to me that, you know, some of the stuff in the Bible, for instance, seemed an awful lot like some of the Greek mythology and Roman mythology and Norse mythology and stuff that I was reading in school. And I just, you know, I didn't believe that God only lived in a church. I didn't believe in a God that cared, you know, what church you went to or what religion you belonged to, for that matter, as long as you were leading a good life. I didn't feel the need I didn't feel threatened by hell or drawn to heaven. I sort of figured those were metaphors for what you make of life here on earth. And I didn't need the threat of hell to compel me to lead a good life. I figured that ought to be a choice that every human being makes, that we should try to be good, as we understand that, because it's the right thing to do, not because we might, you know, fry in hell later on if we don't. Listen, people are entitled to their faith. You know, if it works for them, great. My wife is a Buddhist. I have, you know, sympathies in that direction. You can be an atheist and be a Buddhist. There's no God in Buddhism. I'm no enemy of spirituality, if you want to call it that. But a lot of the venom is just unfortunate.
Ron Reagan will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com, from audible.com, where you can download and listen to NPR programs like Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers, audible.com/freshair, and by TIAA Craft, offering financial solutions to people in education as well as investors nationwide. TIAA-CREF.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more with Ron Reagan about life in the Reagan family. Also, critic at large John Powers considers what makes HBO different from the TV broadcast networks. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Ron Reagan. He's going to speak next Tuesday at the Democratic Convention to explain why he thinks it's important to pursue stem cell research. He will not participate in the Republican Convention's tribute to his late father. Reagan has edited a new book called If You Had 5 Minutes with the President. Now, this new book features people saying, you know, writing what they'd say to the president or to a president if they had 5 minutes with him. Have you tried that exercise yourself? If you had 5 minutes with President Bush, do you know what you'd want to say to him?
Yeah, I wrote in the foreword that if I had 5 minutes with just any president, that I would probably ask them something about Darwinian evolution. Now, that seems, you know, willfully obscure, but the way people think about that particular issue says a lot about how they view the world and the universe that we live in. And so I'd want to know the any president's take on that to sort of gauge the sophistication of their worldview, you know, as a matter of science. If it were President Bush in particular, I might be interested in that question, although he's already cast some doubt on his belief in Darwinian evolution. I think he might agree with Tom DeLay that it's, you know, teaching kids that we evolutionized up from the mud, as he said after the Columbine atrocity. But President Bush, I think I would be moved to ask him whether the innocents in Afghanistan and Iraq, the innocent civilians there who've died under our bombs, and there are now, 10, 15,000 perhaps of those people, if in his mind they were going to be welcomed into heaven as he understands it. I think that particularly given the times that we live in where we're facing an enemy, and it's a real enemy who has a view of us as infidels and, he's going to drown us in a lake of fire and all that because we're godless heathens, whether our own president thinks in similar terms of them. Most of these people in Afghanistan and Iraq are, of course, Muslims. Does he think that they're going to go to heaven, these innocents, these children in many cases who've died? What does he think about them, about that and about them? Does he keep them in his prayers at night? Does he mention them in his prayer circle? I think the answer to that would be very telling.
The 5 minutes that you've given the writers in this book, did you ever have that kind of 5 minutes with your father when he was president? You know, just like asking questions to the president as opposed to asking questions to dad.
No, I always just ask questions to dad. I was asked by many people who I worked for, would you be willing to interview your father? And inevitably I would say no. That doesn't make any sense. For me to actually interview my father in a professional capacity or a journalistic capacity, on the one hand, I'd either be ambushing him, which I wouldn't do, or I would be doing a puff piece, which is pointless. So there would just be no reason for me to interview him in that way. If I want to talk to my father, if I wanted to talk to my father, I could just go in and talk to him. But it would always be father to son.
The idea of family values was very important during your father's administration. And family values were interpreted as being about the traditional nuclear family. And it wasn't about feminism, or there wasn't really room for homosexuality, gay relationships. And in a way, there wasn't a lot of acknowledgement about how messy family life often is, the realities of divorces and feuds and just all the messiness of family life. And because of that, I think some of your father's critics thought that the pro-family agenda was based either on a fantasy or on hypocrisy, in the sense that even in your own family, there were some of the problems that so many families face. Your father was the first president to have been divorced. There are times when your parents weren't on the best of terms with their own children. You lived out of wedlock with the woman who you later married. Now, didn't just about everybody do that, but it wasn't part of the, quote, pro-family agenda. That would have really been condemned. Your sister, Patty, taught a seminar in recovering from dysfunctional families. So I guess I'm wondering if it's the kind of thing you ever wanted to talk with your father about, knowing that you were violating some of those rules yourself just by, living out of wedlock with a woman who you later married, and you've been married to for 20 years.
Yeah, almost 24, actually. November, it'll be 24.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it's amazing how many people say, you're kidding, 24 years? God. It's kind of sad, actually, that you're sort of singled out as being some kind of, marriage icon after a certain amount of time. I've had discussions with my father about some of these issues. I'm sure I can't remember, verbatim what exactly we said to one another years ago. This is a recurring theme in American culture and American politics, certainly. We see it now with the whole gay marriage debate. It's curious to me that for so long, people who were pushing family values and promoting marriage, and I believe that this administration is proposing that we spend, X number of billions of dollars to promote marriage in certain communities, certain poor communities mostly, which may be all well and good, but at the same time they're saying that there's a certain class of people that we're not going to allow to marry. We don't like them because, they don't form stable relationships. But when they want to form stable relationships, we're going to stand in their way just because, it makes us uncomfortable. That's really what it is. I've heard religious arguments against gay marriage. I've heard political arguments against gay marriage. I've heard the emotional argument against gay marriage, which is really, what the others rest on, which is sort of a, yuck, it makes me uncomfortable, so let's have a law against it. But that's, we really need to get beyond that. We need to be more mature as a culture. It's not going to threaten any heterosexual marriage. You said, I've been married for 24 years. My wife and I aren't going to get a divorce just because Rick and Steve can now get married. That's just absurd. I have yet to hear a rational argument for prohibiting homosexuals from marrying one another.
I assume that through your father's early years in Hollywood and your mother's closeness to so many people in the world of design, that they knew a lot of people who were gay. And I'm wondering if you think that that affected your father's political views of homosexual rights.
My father was born in 1911. He was from a generation that wasn't, particularly comfortable with homosexuality. He grew up at a time when, of course, it was all very closeted and all. But he, at the same time, he did know many, many gay men and I'm sure lesbians in Hollywood. He might not have known he knew lesbians, but
right.
But I'm sure he must have. and he saw all these people. He would have seen them as children of God, and he might have thought that they were, they had gone down some unfortunate path by being homosexuals. I never asked him, but he might have thought that it was a choice instead of a condition of birth. I don't know that, but that's possible. But he never tried to scapegoat them or go after them. I know that some people who associated themselves with him, some in the moral majority, do use gay people as scapegoats. They are the only minority now that you can still slander with some impunity. But that's changing, Give it another generation or so, and I think we'll see gay marriage and we'll see the end of gay bashing, I would suspect.
My guest is Ron Reagan. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Ron Reagan. Let's get back to talking about his late father, President Reagan. You were 8 when he was elected governor of California. And so after being governor, he became president. I mean, he was a busy man.
Yeah.
How much time did you get to spend with him?
Well, actually, he was a busy man, but he didn't like to be too busy. He guarded his private life jealously. He was the sort of person, hardworking but not a workaholic. He didn't need the job to sort of complete him. So he enjoyed coming home in the evening. We had dinner together more often than not, for sure. Most nights we would eat dinner together as a family. And he loved to come out, you know, on the weekends or in the evenings or whatever, and, you know, get into a game of touch football on the lawn with the neighborhood kids and me. On the weekend, sometimes, of course, he'd have to work, and he'd be at home in his office and, you know, going through papers or whatever. And, you know, I'd have friends over. We'd be playing football. And I'd move the game around to the front yard because I knew that his window overlooked the front yard. And I knew that if he saw us playing out there, that pretty soon, given a half an hour or so, he wouldn't be able to resist leaving the desk and coming out and playing with us, which indeed he would do. He would always insist on being quarterback for both teams because he didn't want to, you know, seem unfair choosing sides. And we had a sort of unspoken agreement that the two of us, we never talked about it, but we just understood that this was the case, that if he was playing quarterback on my team and I was, you know, going out for a pass or whatever with the other kids, that he would look to the other kids first to throw the ball to. And only if all of them were, you know, covered or had fallen down or whatever, would he throw the ball to me, because he didn't want the other kids to feel like it was all sort of nepotism and, you know, he was favoring me in any way. And I understood that. And so we just had that unspoken agreement.
Did he show movies at home, either his or favorites by actors who he knew?
Yeah, we'd occasionally see movies in our house in Los Angeles. We had he had a little projection booth in the living room. A tiny little room with a projector in it and a little window. You could slide a painting across the wall, and there would be these little, windows for the film to be shown through. And he'd set up a screen. You know, we'd do this thing with a tripod, and you unfurl the white screen and all. We'd occasionally see movies. Sometimes, one of his. Sometimes something else. I also remember I must have been. Oh, I'm guessing 12, 13 years old, maybe. He took me aside and he said, there's some stuff I want to show you here. I think you're old enough now. And he had been, during World War II, he'd been involved with the outfit that would take in all the newsreels and things that were coming from the battlefields and overseas. And he had saved a lot of the footage from the liberation of the concentration camps. And he wanted me to understand how bad things can get, how awful other people can be to their fellow human beings. And I remember to this day watching those raw, unedited newsreels, and it had quite an impact.
How old were you?
I'm guessing that it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 12 to 13 years old.
And did you talk about it with him afterwards?
Oh, sure. Just about the evil that can lurk in people and how even good people can be bullied or somehow drawn into doing these terrible sorts of things to other human beings, and how you always had to be watchful for that and to guard against that. You know, that sort of temptation in yourself, not to the extent, obviously, of, you know, concentration camps, but that, you know, people are capable of bad things as well as good, and that's important to keep in mind.
When your father was shot, mm-hmm. I mean, obviously the nation was horrified. You went to be at your father's bedside as soon as you heard about it. And I guess I'm thinking about the impulse to protect your father and make sure he spends a lot of time in bed and healing afterwards and slowly going about recovery and not taking on too much. And then knowing that, you know, the country wants him to, like, become president again as soon as, you know, like, assume his duties again as soon as possible. Was that, like, a conflicting period for you, you know, wanting to protect him from the burdens and pressures of the office and at the same time knowing that he really had to get back to it as soon as possible?
Yeah, although we knew that my mother had that area covered pretty well. I mean, there was nobody who was more protective of my father than his wife. So that wasn't a huge concern. But yes, you do feel protective. I wasn't really crazy about him running for a second term because, you know, there are more John Hinckleys out there who might, you know, feel compelled to take a shot at them or whatever. So, yes, that there's that protective feeling. The more immediate feeling, of course, when he was shot was that I wanted to find this Hinckley guy and, you know, beat him to death with my bare hands, but which is something that I've tried to get over through the years. But my father forgave him right away. He knew that he couldn't ask for forgiveness for his own sins, as it were, without forgiving the crazy young man who had done this to him.
You know, for most people who are lucky enough to have a parent who lives into an old age, they also have the pain of watching their parent endure pain or a terminal illness or dementia caused from Alzheimer's or another illness. And, it hurts to watch someone who you love, who'd always seemed so powerful when you were a child, now be in a weakened, compromised state. Now, for your father, he was not only your father, he was the former president of the United States, somebody who was in a powerful state, not only for you personally as your father, but as, you know, the head of the free world. So were there parts of his personality that remained even when his memory was gone and even when he couldn't, you know, communicate verbally with you anymore?
Yes, remarkably so. Even really up to the very end, he was unable to speak and communicate effectively for some time, of course. But even up to the very end, you could see glimpses of his personality. He was actually a very gentle man, very kind man, very considerate of other people, treated everybody the same. I mean, whether you were, you know, the doorman or the Queen of England, you got the same treatment from him. He was the same person with you. And that was apparent right up to the end, as I said.
Now, you are a reporter and analyst now for MSNBC, and you've been working with...
It makes it sound very fancy, reporter and analyst. Sometimes I think of myself as a citizen embed in the pundit corps. I'm just sort of a pissed-off citizen who often wonders what everybody's talking about. Everybody's so interested in the horse race all the time, and I'm thinking, you know, I'm interested in whether this is right or wrong, not whether, you know, somebody's going to score points off of it. So anyway, but yes, go ahead.
Well, and you've been working in the media, you know, for years, like since the late 80s probably. Yeah,
mid to late 80s.
And in a way, I might have thought that, you know, growing up in the media spotlight, that you might have wanted to, like, get out of the media, that you might have really not liked journalists or journalism. So I'm just wondering how, you know, growing up in the political media spotlight affected your thoughts on journalism in the media.
Well, I mean, you know, you realize that some people in the media will sometimes be unfair, will take unnecessary shots. But, you know, you get used to that. That happens to everybody who's in the public eye, whether you're a politician or a, you know, movie actor or whatever it might be. As far as getting into journalism, well, I didn't intend to originally. Originally, I wanted to be a ballet dancer and, in fact, was for a while with the Joffrey Ballet. When I left that, I really was just sort of looking around for some way to make some money, and I started writing for magazines, and then kind of fell into television in a way, but was amazed, having made, you know, $11,000 a year as a ballet dancer, that you could actually make, you know, like a living wage doing this television stuff. That was just remarkable to me. And so I kept doing it and kept doing it and got reasonably good at it, I guess. And then, you know, you turn around, you look back at your resume, and it's got all this stuff about television in it, and that begins to seem like, you know, kind of what your career is. I'm not a real careerist. I have to admit, I don't sit around plotting my career path all the time, which is probably a mistake, and it's, you know, probably why I'm, you know, where I am instead of someplace grand. But, you know, that's just the way I am. I guess I concentrate more on my private life than the professional stuff.
Now, I want to get back to next week. You'll be speaking at the Democratic Convention about stem cell research. This is speculation, I know, and you might not be comfortable speculating about this, but do you ask yourself what your father would have thought if he knew that you were speaking at the Democratic Convention and if he knew that you were speaking on behalf of stem cell research? So those are two separate issues, I think.
Well, he pr- I would like to think that he'd be happy and proud that his, you know, his son or any of his children were speaking out for something that they believed in, whether that was at a Democratic National Convention or somewhere else. On the issue of embryonic stem cell research, many people have floated the idea that he wouldn't have approved of it. They don't have any right to speak for him, and I won't speak for him. I don't know what he would have thought. I never had a chance to ask him. The person who knew him better than anybody else on Earth, which is my mother, seems to feel that he would have supported embryonic stem cell research, and so I'll take her word for it.
How is your mother, and how is her health?
She's doing okay. This is difficult, of course. She was married to him for 53 years. Now he is not there anymore. That's an adjustment that you have to make, and it's a difficult one. But she's strong, and I think she's going to be fine. She's got a new dog. Her good friend Merv Griffin gave her a Shar Pei puppy, which she named Duchess, after Dutch, of course. And she's going to be fine. The dog helps.
Sure. Sure. Well, thank you so much for talking with us.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
Ron Reagan will speak next Tuesday at the Democratic Convention. He's edited and written the foreword for a new book called If You Had 5 Minutes with the President. HBO has received nearly twice as many Emmy nominations as any broadcast network. Coming up, critic at large John Powers considers what makes HBO different. This is Fresh Air. The Emmys were announced last week, and leading the nominations with 21 was the HBO miniseries Angels in America. Next up with 20 nominations was the HBO drama The Sopranos, 7 more than last year. Our critic at large, John Powers, wasn't surprised by HBO's big tally.
When the Emmy nominations came out recently, HBO received 124 of them, nearly twice as many as the next highest network. The startling thing wasn't that HBO got so many, but anyone still found this startling. While HBO is far from America's most watched network, in fact, all 4 of the major broadcasters outdraw it every single day, it is the one that's been shaping our popular mythology. In a period otherwise dominated by reality TV, when the year's most quoted line is, "You're fired," HBO tells stories that have viewers talking. Is Adriana going to get away with betraying the Sopranos? Will Carrie really wind up with that aging reptile, Mikhail Baryshnikov? And did you see this week's 6 Feet Under, where that psycho hijacks David and starts messing with the dead body? Such excitement isn't purely a product of skillful writing, though that shouldn't be underestimated. It's a question of imaginative intent. HBO's best programs do for today's TV what the famous 1970s movies did for Hollywood. They capture aspects of reality and create memorable characters that go far beyond the norm of routine television. In fact, HBO is the wayward id of network TV, its shows presenting a murkier and more amoral version of already existing programs. The Wire is Law and Order without either law or order. Sex and the City is Friends, but with sex and the city. The Italian-American family madness of The Sopranos is a murderous mirror of Everybody Loves Raymond. You better watch out for those bullying matriarchs. And 6 Feet Under plays like a metaphysical riposte to CSI. Both programs always begin with a dead body, but where the cop show ties up everything neatly, Alan Ball's drama about a family of morticians does just the opposite. It suggests that the meaning of everything is always elusive, buried. Just as the 70s movies took us inside bad behavior, with all those easy riders and raging bulls, HBO makes a specialty of showing us fascinating jerks, from Tony Soprano to the yobbish Hollywood hangers-on in its new series Entourage. None is more enjoyable than the self-absorbed Larry David of Curb Your Enthusiasm, which is like a Seinfeld that doesn't rein in its misanthropy. Where network shows shy away from controversy, think of how CBS pulled its Ronald Reagan biopic. Curb Your Enthusiasm gleefully brings sacred cows to the slaughter. Here, Larry David is about to renew his wedding vows when he offends his rabbi with an offhand reference to 9/11.
Okay. All right, everybody ready?
Yeah.
All right, let's roll.
What? Let's roll? What did you say?
What?
You know that my brother-in-law died on September 11th. How dare you say something like that?
With all due respect, wasn't that just a coincidence? All right, poor choice of words.
What the hell kind of a...
All right, that's wrong.
You know, I don't want to do this.
I'm sorry. Forget it. Oh, I didn't know that if you died uptown on 9/11, that it was part of it, the tragedy.
Do I have to go on and on about this?
I didn't know that an uptown death on West 57th Street was part of the tragedy.
I don't think I want to do this.
Perhaps nothing captures the network's allure better than its brilliantly ambiguous slogan, "It isn't TV, it's HBO," which allows it to play a marvelous double game. HBO positions itself as classy programming for the elite, while also implying that it will give you all the nudity and swearing you can't get on free TV. It has the cachet of PBS, only cool, and this makes it catnip for the media folk who create the national buzz. Of course, as a subscription channel, HBO doesn't have to make shows intended to appeal to everyone. That was fine 40 years ago, when the whole country watched the same three channels. But we live in a big box culture now, with scores of channels, and viewers raised on the idea of niche viewing. These days, nothing is duller than to be stuck in the middle, caught trying to appeal to a mainstream that is becoming a trickle. For the last 100 years, modern culture has been all about the creative tension between high and low, trash and art. At the moment, nobody milks this tension more neatly than HBO. It can offer both a high-toned production like Angels in America and a lucrative franchise like Real Sex, a series so nudie and smirky that just watching 2 minutes makes me want to join the nearest monastery. HBO's best serials bring the high and low together at the same time. They're great works of popular culture. They capture the crazy quilt texture of contemporary life, where gangsters dream of getting into the movies, cops know that nobody's quite clean, families share the same house but live in voluminous solitude, and women talk about sex more frankly than men. At a time when storytelling seems like a lost art, HBO has taught America to say, bada bing.
John Powers writes the column On for LA Weekly and is the author of the new book, Sore Winners, which will be published next week. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Dial Press, publisher of The Summer Guest, a novel of love, family secrets, and a dying man's last wish by Justin Cronin, author of the collection Mary and O'Neill. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we remember composer Jerry Goldsmith. He's died at the age of 75. He wrote scores for the films Chinatown, Patton, The Omen, and L.A. Confidential. Also, actor Matt Damon. He's starring in The Bourne Supremacy, the sequel to his thriller, The Bourne Identity. Join us for the next Fresh Air.